Today we're thinking again about diligence and a firm foundation. Hey, welcome to another look into the life and message of Elizabeth Elliot. She called us to a higher standard. As our series continues, we'll hear from family, friends, and others influenced by her life and message. Hey, welcome. Thanks for joining us today. Well, we're wrapping up our short series on the subject of diligence today. We'll be hearing from one of Elizabeth's brothers, Tom Howard, as he talks about laughter, composure, and accents. Elizabeth loved hymns, and today we look at two of the great hymns of the faith, How Firm a Foundation, and Crown Him with Many Crowns. That coming a little bit later. But first, think about your work done for God. Now, work that's godly work, done for Him, does that include digging a trench and then filling it up again? Recognizing God's control over our lives and over this world. Also, looking at Mary and Martha. You identify more with which one of those two biblical ladies? Think about that with us today. Here's part four of Diligence, Being Employed by Christ.
You are loved with an everlasting love. That's what the Bible says. And underneath are the everlasting arms. This is your friend, Elizabeth Elliot, talking with you one more time on the subject of diligence. We were talking yesterday about that amazing man, Walter Chizik, who was put into a Russian concentration camp, a labor camp, and had to work in bitter cold with very little food, very little clothing. And he saw this as work actually done for God, even when he was being asked to dig a trench and then fill it up again, or break stones and carry them up a hill and carry them back down again. Stupid, meaningless work, almost satanically designed to break a man's spirit. And Walter Chizik came out of that prison camp strong and shining for God, because in every situation of his life, he recognized that God was in control and that absolutely no second cause could ever prevent him from doing the will of God. And I do believe that. No human being except yourself can ever prevent you from doing the will of God. It is always possible to do the will of God. And we're thinking particularly this week about doing it diligently, not half-heartedly, but earnestly, wholeheartedly, carefully. Now, why should we do our work diligently? Well, for the simple reason that it's for God. Suppose the Queen of England were coming to visit your house. You would clean that house more diligently, probably, than you've ever cleaned it in your life. Why? Well, because of who it is that's coming. Whatever you do, put your whole heart and soul into it, as into work done for the Lord, and not merely for men, knowing that your real reward, a heavenly one, will come from the Lord, since you are actually employed by the Lord Christ, and not just by your earthly master. I'm reading from a different translation than the one I gave you, but it's the same passage. It's Colossians 3, 23 and 24, if you want to look it up, and you might want to copy out those five words, employed by the Lord Christ. Will that make a difference in the way you iron that shirt? Will that make a difference in the way you work in that machine shop or drive that truck or do whatever prisoners are required to do or work at a desk in an office? Or teach a class, or sit in an old folks' home. You know, there's something for every one of us to do, and it is always possible to do the will of God. I remember hearing Johnny Erickson tell about a friend of hers who was even more paralyzed than Johnny, and that friend works. She prays all day long. She has a big prayer list up on the wall beside her. She can't move a muscle except her eyes, but she can read that prayer list. Why should we do our work diligently? Well, number one, because we love God. Number two, because we accept our work as a gift from Him. Number three, because we offer it to Him first and foremost, not merely to the boss or to my husband or my children or the people at church or the PTA or the Bloodmobile. We offer it to God. We are actually employed by the Lord Christ. Do it as work done for the Lord, not merely for men, knowing that your real reward, a heavenly one, will come from the Lord, since you are actually employed by the Lord Christ, and not just by your earthly master. But don't forget, you're also employed by an earthly master, and what he tells you to do, you must do. He is the authority that God has put over you, and in serving him, you're serving God. Have you ever thought of it that way? Have you thought of putting God in the place of that person for whom you work? And realizing that as you offer it to that person for money, you are offering it to God for love. Now, diligent doesn't mean frantic or anxious or hurried or fanatical or frenzied. You remember that beautiful story of Jesus going for supper at the home of Mary and Martha and Lazarus. Poor Martha. We all love Martha. And most of us women, I think, identify very easily with Martha because she was toiling away out in the kitchen all by herself, and Mary, her sister, was sitting at Jesus' feet. And understandably, she got a little irritated with Mary because Mary didn't seem to be aware of the fact that there were things that needed to be done for this guest. And Jesus was not sending Mary away. Now, what was it Jesus chided Martha for? If she had been merely diligent, he would never have rebuked her. The problem was that she was not just diligent. She was full of care, frantic, troubled, not only about the meal, but about her sister's not doing what she thought of as her share. In modern parlance, we'd say she was stressed out. She was hassled, and therefore undoubtedly exhausted. Do you remember my talks on the yoke of Jesus? It's the way to find rest. Matthew 11:28. Jesus says, "Come to me, all you who are tired and overburdened, and I will give you rest." But this is what we have to do if we're going to receive his rest. He says, "Take my yoke upon you and learn of me, for I am gentle and humble in heart, and you will find rest for your souls." What do you think the yoke of Jesus is? That yoke that he asks us to take before we can find that rest. It must be the will of the Father. That's the yoke that Jesus himself bore. He's not laying a different yoke on you and me. He says, "Take my yoke upon you." The will of the Father. Do we try to meet all our obligations and occupations quietly and perform them with regularity, one after the other? Have you ever tried to do two or three jobs all at the same time? I know what it's like. You decide this is laundry day, so you run upstairs after breakfast, leaving the dishes, and while you went upstairs to get the laundry, you suddenly realize that there are a couple of beds that haven't been stripped yet, so you have to go in and you strip the beds and you take the laundry off them, and then you find that somebody has left some clothes on the floor that also need to go in the laundry basket. And finally, when you get the laundry basket all ready to go, then of course the telephone rings and you're on the phone so long that you forget what you were going to do, and the next thing you find yourself cleaning the bathroom. Oh, but I meant to do the laundry. So then finally you go take the laundry downstairs, and when you take the laundry down, you remember that you'd forgotten to wash the dishes. And so it goes. You frantically go from one thing to the other without any real order or plan. God never gives us more than one thing to do at a time. If you try to do it all at once, you're in confusion, and you're going to overcharge your batteries. You're going to burn out. You're going to become depressed and angry and fearful. These three things do go together. Did you know that? I've noticed that. When people are depressed, almost invariably, they are angry. Angry at somebody, probably angry at God. And when you're depressed and angry, there's also another thing that goes along with that, and it's fear. Walter Chizik, the man in the Russian concentration camp, saw his work as cooperation with God. Now, is this a scriptural concept? I want to try to show you that it is. In Exodus chapter 14, verses 16 and 17, we read, "The Lord said to Moses, 'Why are you crying out to me? Tell the Israelites to move on.'" Now, do you remember where the Israelites were? They were between the devil, as it were, and the deep blue sea, only it was the Egyptians and the deep red sea, in an impossible position. And God says to Moses, tell them to move on. But he also gave Moses something to do, to cooperate with him. "Raise your staff and stretch out your hand over the sea to divide the water so that the Israelites can go through the sea on dry ground. I will harden the hearts of the Egyptians so that they will go in after them, and I will gain glory through Pharaoh and all his army, through his chariots and his horsemen." And so you remember what happened. Moses cooperated with God by doing the apparently useless, futile thing. He raised his staff and stretched out his hand. Was that what divided the sea? Partly, yes. It was a man's cooperation with a miracle of God. Moses did the one thing he could do, and God did what Moses couldn't do. And that's the way it is with our work. And then God will do the part that we can't do. In the 10th chapter of Joshua, there's a very interesting story. The five kings of the Amorites were after the people of Israel. And Joshua marched up from Gilgal with his entire army, including all the best fighting men. And the Lord said to Joshua, "Do not be afraid of them. I have given them into your hand. Not one of them will be able to withstand you." And after an all-night march from Gilgal, Joshua took them by surprise. The Lord threw them into confusion. Israel pursued them along the road, and the Lord hurled hailstones down on them, and more of them died from the hailstones than were killed by the swords of the Israelites. And then Joshua says to the Lord in the presence of Israel, "O sun, stand still over Gibeon." And in verse 13, it says, "The sun stood still." It was Joshua's prayer that moved the hand of God to stop the sun. You and I are given the privilege of doing things for God's glory. There's a huge bonus in the process. It deepens our understanding of who He is and broadens our perspectives.
The conclusion of our four-part look at diligence being employed by Christ. Well, instead of two guests, we're just going to take an extended look at the life of Elizabeth with her brother, Dr. Tom Howard. This is back in 2015 at the memorial service at Gordon College. Dr. Tom Howard. A look at laughter, books, media attention, composure, and even accents.
My sister Elizabeth, or as the family called her, Betty, was 8 years older than I, so that when she was a teenager, I was still a small boy. I point this out simply to emphasize an oddity, namely that she and I had an extraordinary relationship from the start. Somehow, even in the midst of the family hurly-burly, we were six children, which would arise amid the uproarious laughter that often marked the household. Somehow, no matter what was going on, Betty and I could always catch each other's eye in an exchange which said, "I know exactly what you are thinking and how you're feeling right now." This touches on something about Betty that her public perhaps never had the chance to see. The thousands of people who became aware of her when her husband, Jim Elliot, was killed in Ecuador, and then, as the years went by, those who were affected by her writings and speeches, these people might see her as a sort of heroic, almost Olympian figure. And that is not entirely a wrong impression. She was all of that, certainly. I think our parents were always a bit awed by her, even before she became well known. But she had an extraordinary capacity for laughter. She would laugh loudly and helplessly, for example, over our father's tales of the pratfalls that seemed to bedevil his footsteps, and at our oldest brother Phil, who was an irrepressible mimic, especially of Scottish or Norwegian or Philadelphia accents. She laughed at sheer wit, certain writers like Joyce Grenfell and Cornelia Otis Skinner. She laughed at radio comedians, and she laughed at the general drollery that marked our family life. I should add here that she herself was an irrepressible mimic, regaling us all with her imitations of remarks that she might hear at the grocer's or on the street or wherever people gathered. She especially liked regional accents, the local South Jersey twang or the Yankee argot that we heard every summer in Franconia, New Hampshire. Over the years, she came increasingly to look to me to tell her what to read. While she was still in Ecuador after Jim's death, I'd send her books by Kierkegaard or Paul Tillich, Dostoevsky, John Updike, François Sagan, and so forth. And as time went on, the works of Cardinal Newman and the Russian Orthodox theologians Alexander Schmemann and Callistus Ware. Of the spiritual writers from the evangelical wing of Protestantism, I would guess that Amy Carmichael would be very near the top of her list. Interestingly enough, she came gradually and, I would say, inexorably to find rest for her soul in the Eucharistic liturgy of the ancient church. I think that perhaps our father's manifest love for what he called the great hymns of the church had instilled in her, as in me, an appreciation of the dignity, weight, and majesty of forms of worship that have been hallowed by long usage. In 1956, she became the focus of attention in the media. Life and Time magazines had articles about her and followed her entry with her small daughter Valerie into the Alca tribe in 1958. She was, in this connection, flown to New York and found herself swept into that world of news and publishing. She found that world vastly intriguing and, in some sense, sympathetic. The non-religious publishers and photographers found themselves bemused by this woman straight from the jungle and the world of Christian missions, so manifestly civilized and at ease among them. Her aplomb pleased and, I think, startled them somewhat. She knew how to hold her fork.
One of the brothers of Elizabeth, that was Dr. Tom Howard. Well, how about looking at a couple well-known Christian hymns with us today? Have you ever found yourself confused? In fact, you're about to break under the stress and give up? Think about Elizabeth during the time when Jim was missing. She eventually found out he had been killed. What was the verse that brought her comfort?
You are loved with an everlasting love. That's what the Bible says. And underneath are the everlasting arms. This is your friend Elizabeth Elliot, talking again today about some of my favorite hymns, the hymns that have been the foundation of my life. And one of today's two hymns is How Firm a Foundation. I can remember my brother Dave Howard singing that when he was a little boy, about 3 years old. My father used to sing with us and to us, and as my father would be working around the house on a Saturday, he would often be singing. And I can see my little brother Dave tagging around after him like a little puppy dog, learning these words, which we often sang in family prayers. How firm a foundation, ye saints of the Lord, is laid for your faith in his excellent word. What more can he say than to you he has said, to you who for refuge to Jesus have fled? There may be someone listening to me today feeling as though the bottom has really dropped out this time, feeling at loose ends, somebody confused, perhaps a man pressured to the breaking point. pressured by business, pressured by a difficult marriage, pressured by the responsibility of a family, and the apparent impossibility of providing for them as you wish you could. What do we do in a time like this? Do you feel as though your faith is just about to disintegrate? Is your mind filled with unanswered questions? Well, here's a powerful hymn for you to learn, and if you can just get your hands on a good old hymn book, just study these words. The second stanza, which I sang as a little child and didn't have the slightest idea what it meant, became tremendously powerful and meaningful in my life when my husband Jim Elliott went into the tribe of Indians called Aucas, and a few days later I received word on the radio that he was missing. The words that God brought to my mind were from Isaiah 43:2, "When thou passest through the waters, I will be with thee, and through the rivers they shall not overflow thee." Now I'm sure that those words in Isaiah are the source of the second or the third stanza of this hymn, "How Firm a Foundation." When through the deep waters I call thee to go, the rivers of sorrow shall not overflow, for I will be with thee, thy troubles to bless, and sanctify to thee thy deepest distress. And, dear friends, it doesn't matter how deep the water may be to which he calls you. The rivers of sorrow shall not overflow. We often feel as though they're about to, but they will not be too great. Why? Because he says, I will be with thee. Thy troubles to bless. Does that sound crazy? God can bless your troubles. He absolutely can. And the last line of that stanza says, and sanctify to thee thy deepest distress. Sanctify thy distress. God has done that for me. In my darkest hours, my deepest waters, my hottest fires, God has been there. God has gone with me. God has been true to his promise. He is with us. He has promised never, 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 never to forsake us. And there really are five negatives in the Greek of that verse in Hebrews. The fourth stanza. When through fiery trials thy pathway shall lie, my grace, all sufficient, shall be thy supply. The flame shall not hurt thee. I only design thy dross to consume and thy gold to refine. And I'm sure that the hymn writer must have had in mind that passage in 1 Peter 1. If gold has to pass through the fire in order to be purified, so does our faith. So God is refining us when through fiery trials our pathway shall lie. And he has promised also the words that Paul writes in 2 Corinthians 12, my grace is all you need. And the hymn writer puts it, my grace all sufficient shall be thy supply. The flame shall not hurt thee. I only design thy dross to consume and thy gold to refine. And the last stanza has been like a strong tower into which I have run again and again when I've been in trouble. The soul that on Jesus hath leaned for repose, I will not desert to his foes. That soul, though all hell should endeavor to shake, I'll never, no, never, no, never forsake. And then, by contrast with this hymn about deep trials, there's a wonderful hymn of praise that I'm sure many of you are familiar with. Crown him with many crowns, the Lamb upon his throne. Hark how the heavenly anthem drowns all music but its own. Awake, my soul, and sing of him who died for thee, and hail him as thy matchless king through all eternity. Now, that's a good hymn to start the day with, because most of us need to take ourselves by the scruff of the neck and say, "Awake, my soul." But don't just awake and stagger, stumbling and scowling into the bathroom and look at yourself in the mirror, but try this: awake, my soul, and sing of him who died for thee. I love that. And then there's a stanza that doesn't occur in most of the hymn books, unfortunately. You know, hymn books keep cutting things out and changing things around and generally mutilating things, and it's too bad because the hymn writers always had a progression in mind, and stanza one led logically to stanza two, and stanza two to stanza three, and so on. So when you chop out the second one or the fourth one or the seventh one, you're chopping out a very important segment of the meaning of the hymn. This hymn, Crown Him with Many Crowns, was written by Matthew Bridges, I believe, in the 19th century. The second stanza: Crown him the Lord of life, who triumphed o'er the grave and rose victorious in the strife for those he came to save. His glories now we sing, who died and rose on high, who died eternal life to bring and lives that death may die. Have you ever thought about the fact that Jesus Christ lives in order that death may die? And death is going to die one of these days. You can depend upon it. He is the death of death and hell's destruction. And a stanza that has been cut out of the hymn book that I have in front of me here, but one of my favorites, says this: Crown him, the Son of God, before the worlds began. And ye who tread where he hath trod, crown him the Son of Man, who every grief hath known, that wrings the human breast, and takes and bears them for his own, that all in him may rest. Now I realize that the words of some of these old hymns are a little bit hard for the modern ear to take in, especially when you just hear them read aloud on the radio and you don't have the hymn book in front of you. So I want to repeat that favorite stanza of mine from the hymn Crown Him with Many Crowns and see if it doesn't have something that has a direct word for your heart and your need today. Crown him the Son of God before the worlds began. In other words, he was the Son of God from the beginning of time. He is the only begotten Son. He is one of the three persons of the Trinity, and he existed before all worlds began. He was not created. He was begotten as the Son of God. We're speaking, of course, of Jesus Christ. Crown him the Son of God before the worlds began. And you who tread where he hath trod, crown him the Son of Man, who every grief hath known that wrings the human breast. So in other words, if you are treading the pathway of grief or suffering or pain or sorrow or pressure of any kind, you are, in fact, treading the path that Jesus Christ trod, the pathway of pain. You who tread where he hath trod, crown him the Son of Man. Remember that he was a man. Remember that he was tempted in all points exactly as you and I are. Crown him the Son of Man, who every grief hath known that rings, and that's W-R-I-N-G-S, just as you wring out a dishcloth, who every grief hath known that wrings the human breast and takes and bears them for his own, that all in him may rest. And may you today surrender to him whatever grief you know, and let him take and bear that grief for his own, so that you in him may rest. And you who don't know him, will you just simply come to him in prayer and say, "Lord, I don't know you, but I want to. Show me yourself. Help me to yield myself to you."
Look at two hymns today: How Firm a Foundation and Crown Him with Many Crowns. Earlier this year, KW wrote, "Elizabeth has shown me over and over to trust and obey our Lord. She has committed to the truth and not swayed by culture and even her own feelings when confronted with what she knew about God. She was content." Letha writes, "Every young person who is serious about following Jesus would benefit from listening to Elizabeth Elliot." That's from audible.com. Well, thank you for listening to our Elizabeth Elliot podcast. And as our time comes to an end, let me thank you for letting us come into your home, your office, maybe along with you as you took a walk. On behalf of the Elizabeth Elliot Foundation, in cooperation with the Bible Broadcasting Network, let me invite you to check out all the resources at elizabethelliot.org. elizabethelliot.org. More talks, Gateway to Joy programs, and other resources. Until next time, may God remind you every day you're loved with an everlasting love. Underneath are those everlasting arms.